Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. Your host, Mono, here to bring you a slice of gaming life from Tokyo. We are closing in on the 10-year anniversary of Pokemon X and Y, so I brought on a special guest, Danny from the Retro Wars podcast, to travel with me back to Kalos. The game's history, its ups and downs, the fascinating legacy, the best Pokemon, all will be covered as we return to Game Freak's first foray into 3D. For the feature, we're heading outside of Tokyo to the neighboring Saitama Prefecture to check out Suzume Publishing Antique Book Club, a store dedicated to selling video game books. I'll tell you about my trip and what to look out for when buying video game books in Japan. And as always, wrap up with a bit of news, including a lot of Nintendo collaborations right here in Japan. Let's get into Pokemon X and Y's 10-year anniversary with Danny from the Retro Wars podcast. Tokyo Game Life, only on the Tokyo Beat Podcast Network. Today in the game section, we are celebrating the 10-year anniversary of Pokemon X and Y. Released October 12, 2013, it heralded the start of Generation 6 of Pokemon and was a major milestone in the franchise as it transitioned to fully 3D graphics. Joining me to dig into everything about this landmark title from Game Freak is a special guest. So guest, please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Danny and I'm from the Retro Wars podcast. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Thanks for joining me. Before we get into X and Y, what's your history with the Pokemon franchise in general?
I'm a Gen 1-er. That's what you would describe me as. I have been there since day dot, ever since the Pokemon franchise came out. I got Pokemon Blue. I've still got my original copies of Pokemon Blue, Red, and Yellow. Still Ooh. Have them to this day. And any time a Pokemon game comes out, I have bought them. And at one stage, I was one of the best in the UK at Pokemon, Ooh. Officially. Officially one of the best in the UK.
All right, well, let's start at the beginning for X and Y. January 8th, 2013, Nintendo held a special Pokemon Direct before they were called Pokemon Presents, and it was hosted by the late, great Satoru Iwata. It announced Pokemon X and Y for Nintendo 3DS. Development started in 2010, and it was the last Pokemon game directed by Junichi Masuda. They showed off some gameplay, they showed off the starters, legendaries, and the release date. It would come out worldwide in October, though to be fair, some countries were excluded, but Japan, US, Europe, and Australia all had the same date. Before this, it would take months or even years before a Pokemon game would leave Japan. What was your reaction to hearing that Pokemon would have a worldwide release?
It was interesting that it was going to happen because if you go back to even Generation 1, so when Generation 1 came out and we were all getting excited for it and it was like, oh, wow, what's this? This is Pokemon. Never even seen it before. And even in the first episode of the anime, Ho-Ho, we're like, what the fudge is that? However, for those who didn't know, Japan were basically already about to hit Gen 2. And we're like, what? What's Gen 2? So we were so far behind the trend, and it remained that way for so long. And finally, I think they'd realized, okay, this console, this where we are now with the 3DS, we're at a stage now where this is worldwide. This can't be, you know, left alone. It has to come out day dot. And also for the fact that the internet had got a lot better. So spoilers were going to be out in seconds. So I don't think they wanted people to be spoiled. Hence why I think it needs to come out now worldwide, which I was so happy with. I was so happy it was a worldwide release. Brilliant.
Yeah, this is definitely around the time where Nintendo kind of shifted to all their games having a worldwide release. And I do remember the days of going to Serebii.net when a Pokemon game came out in Japan, and it would just be random info and like these weird transliterations of their names from Japanese. So have it day and date as Japan was a really, really big deal that I think a lot of youngsters don't realize. They take it for granted now.
I look back at Serebii now and think of all the work that the guy who runs it, Joe, has to do. Like, I've met Joe.
Oh, awesome.
I met him at a competition. And I just shook his hand and went, do you know what, mate? I know we never met, but thank you for everything you've done. Which I don't think he probably does realize, but all the work he does how he does it, I don't know. He's like literally the Pokemon man. It's crazy. Yes.
So Pokemon X and Y, it was the first Pokemon RPG developed by Game Freak to use full 3D models as opposed to the sprite-based look of the past games. What did you think about the transition of the actual Pokemon models from sprites to 3D models?
Oh, I thought two things. Okay, so at first I was happy because I'm like, okay, great. Nintendo need to go down this, or Game Freak need to go down this route. It's been so long. It's the fact that we're, you know, on the 3DS, we're still using the four directional, and now we can go eight directional or whatever directional. It's like, fantastic. We've needed that for so, so long. And to see all our Pokemon now in full 3D, fantastic. It's great. It's like I've got Pokemon Colosseum or Pokemon Stadium in my hand. It looks that good. But at the same time, I thought to myself, oh, well, if that's the case, we're never getting Pokemon Stadium again, are we? That's dead. And I was like, aw, I like Pokemon Stadium. So it was like a bittersweet pill, really.
Yes. A bit of a background on these models. They were created by Creatures with the intention of them being future-proof, meaning that they could be imported into future games, and not just XY. For example, Sun and Moon, Pokemon Go, and Let's Go uses these same models, for example.
So does Sword and Shield.
Yes, definitely. They've been using it for, over a decade now. It's kind of hard to think about, but Creatures also made a special development branch called Pokemon CG Studio, specifically to handle their creation. To me, this was one of the wow moments of the game. Much like Pokemon Stadium, like you said, there is a novelty in seeing these sprites rendered in full 3D. Some Pokemon really stand out after making the transition. Like Spinda, he stumbles around in kind of a funny way. And a lot of the flying Pokemon are mid-flight.
Yeah.
One 3D model that really sticks out for me is Lovedisc, because I never thought of it being so thick. But again, part of the fun is seeing the Pokemon in 3D, and then you learn something new about them. Were there any specific 3D models that stood out for you?
Oh, look, seeing the big three was always great, to see Charizard, Blastoise, and Venusaur. But for me, I think seeing Pokemon like Gyarados fully actually, like, wow, that's what it's like in the anime. That looks absolutely cool. Mm. That looks absolutely amazing. I think really I was taken aback by the Mega Evolutions, because they were all brand new. Like, we've seen, you know, Venusaur, Charizard, Blastoise, we've seen them on Pokemon Stadium, Colosseum, etc. But to now see all these new ones come out, I was like, okay, seeing them flying consistently, it's like, oh, this looks so good. I was like, my little mind couldn't take it about how good some of these Pokemon looked in 3D, like Mega Aggron. Oh, God. Just outrageously good, like sickening good.
Yeah, a major calling card of Pokemon X and Y is the introduction of Mega Evolutions. Usable once per battle, these transform specific Pokemon into super forms, giving them a stat boost and sometimes changing their typing or abilities. For example, Charizard X went from Fire Flying to Fire Dragon. What did you think about the introduction of Mega Pokemon?
Game-changing. Absolutely game-changing. At least, basically, I think they looked at Digimon enough and gone, right, it's time to really steal the Digimon trend. I was like, okay, we're going to pinch that completely. It was like, no, it's our idea. You didn't, no, not you, Digimon. It's our idea. It's mine. But it changed the VGC scene dramatically, because competitively, you use doubles. That's how it's been for a long time.
Right.
And some of these Pokemon, it basically allowed some Pokemon who you'd never, ever play, ever, becoming literally staples. Okay, so Pinsir. God, Mega Pinsir was incredible, but you're never going to use that in double battles. You just won't.
Mm.
But then you've got Pokemon, or the main ones who you'd want to use were Mega Mawile. That saw usage. Wow, okay, you never thought you'd see that before. Then you've got Pokemon like Mega Lucario. You never thought you'd see that. Maybe not. Maybe Lucario. But the one that got the most usage and of anyone was Kangaskhan.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Mega Kangaskhan was broken. I don't know how much broken you knew it was, but that thing had to get nerfed when it got to Generation 7. It was so powerful, they had to nerf it.
Yeah, Mega Evolution really did start the trend of, okay, this gen will have a temporary battle gimmick that gives your Pokemon crazy powers, which we didn't see before. And after this, we got Z-moves, then Gigantamax, then Terra-types. So XY, it really is the start of modern Pokemon games in a way.
Yeah.
Out of all the things I listed, I definitely think Mega Pokemon is the most fun.
Oh, it has, definitely.
It has a much more distinct impact on battles. For example, Mega Venusaur gives it a completely new ability that prevents fire and ice attacks from being super effective. So this completely forces the opponent to change their strategy. They can no longer just use an ice attack on Venusaur to knock it out. It's way more cerebral. And if your opponent has multiple Pokemon that can turn into Mega Pokemon, well, which one is it going to be? You need to stay on your toes.
But sometimes, though, just because it's Mega doesn't make it better. And so a Pokemon like Venusaur, you mentioned, yes, it can become Mega Venusaur. However, competitively, you'd rather keep it as Venusaur because it has the ability Chlorophyll, which under sunlight, it gains double its speed. And then who has automatic sun when they come out? Mega Charizard Y. So those two teamed together were incredible. Gyarados, you would never use Mega Gyarados. Never, never, never. It was water dark and its move was Mold Breaker, which was terrible. So you lose the Intimidate. Although some of them had it, doesn't necessarily mean better. And I thought that was quite interesting because it basically means that, okay, just because you've got it doesn't mean you should use it. It's an option, but it's not always going to be the go-to. And I love that. I really did.
Yeah, especially like you said before, Charizard and Venusaur, if you have them both on your team, the opponent might not know exactly which one is the Mega Pokemon. I'm sure if they battled that combo time and time again, they probably figured it out. But there is some sort of mind games with it. I remember my team on X and Y, I used Venusaur, I used Heracross, and maybe some other Pokemon that could Mega Evolve. So it was kind of like, oh, I'm trying to trick my opponent a bit. They don't know which one I'm going to toss out and even which one has Mega Pokemon abilities. And a lot of the designs, they look really crazy, maybe too crazy, but I think they did a great job in conveying what could be the next step for these fully evolved Pokemon. But admittedly, it was pretty broken. Not all Pokemon were created equally. Mega Genghis Khan, like you said before, and also I feel Mega Gengar was also very, very powerful.
Yes.
And we definitely got way too many, especially when Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire came out. But I thought it was a really fun and creative battle gimmick.
Oh, I love Wake Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire when that came out. I was like, please just give me more Megas. Please give me more Megas. And oh my God, they did. And when I saw Slowbro was getting a Mega, I was like, oh, please, I can't wait to see what he looks like. I was like, oh, he looks poo. But everybody else, like, again, some of them were just incredible to see. Mega Salamance just became amazing. Mega Rayquaza is my favorite looking Pokemon of all time. It's just, oh, put that in the shiny form in black. It's just heaven. Heaven on earth. And I was quite sad when we went to Generation 6 and we got Z moves. I was like, oh, that's boring. I don't want Z moves. I want them to change appearance. I want them to look cool. I want them to look different. So when they did it in Generation 8, I was loving it. I was like, yay, Dynamax, they all look different. And I think I love it when they can change Pokemon's appearance. I just think that is so cool. I wish they'd do it every time.
Now, Mega Evolutions have been kind of phased out, but maybe XY's biggest contribution to the Pokemon series as a whole are the fairy Pokemon. It was the first new type since Gold and Silver, and we haven't had a new type since. No. What's your feeling on fairy Pokemon?
At first, when they first hit the scene, they were, again, so overpowered because you had Gardevoir was a fairy type. You had Sylveon, who was the Eevee fairy. The Mega for this game, or like the box Uber, was Yveltal and Xerneas. Xerneas was so broken in competitive play. Like if it used its ability once and you didn't have anything to counter it, you'd lost. You just straight lost. So I think it took a while for them to actually get the balance right because there wasn't enough poison types to really go against. Like although there was the Mega Gengar, Gengar's still in trouble for some of its other abilities, and it took a while for them to get that balance right. But I love the fact they brought a new type in. I'm still surprised they've not brought another new type in, but maybe they think, you know, we've got to the stage now of 18 types. That's probably enough. Otherwise, it's going to be too chaotic. And maybe that they brought in the fairy type kind of just to put a balance in things, to give dark types another weakness, you know, and give fighting types another weakness, just balance it out a little bit. And yeah, I think, should it ever change? No, I think we've got enough types now. I think you've pretty much covered everything. I don't know what they would do to increase it further.
Yeah, it felt like they were implemented kind of as a counter to Dragon Pokemon, which were really dominating the competitive scene, especially in Gen 5. There were just so many prominent Dragon Pokemon. And by making Fairy Pokemon not only super effective against Dragon Pokemon, but making them completely immune to Dragon attacks, definitely threw a wrench into the era of Dragon dominance. And some Pokemon were retconned to be fairy, like Jigglypuff and Clefairy, which makes sense because it has fairy in its name. And I really do love that there is basically a section for cute pink Pokemon, although not all of them are pink. And I'm a huge fan of Sylveon, both its design and using it in the game.
Yeah.
And speaking of new Pokemon, this game has some. Infamously, I suppose, the number of new Pokemon is quite low. There are 72 new creatures, with three of them being mythicals, so only 69 new Pokemon in the main game. What did you think about introducing such a low number of new Pokemon in this generation?
I think they were going back again to Generation 1. I was like, right, okay, what can we bring in? You know, the fact they were bringing Mega Evolution mates that can heavily rely on Venusaur, Charizard, and Blastoise.
Mm.
You rely on your past to bring in a lot of people because we all know how the marketing can go quite well towards that. I wasn't too fussed with having 71 Pokemon. I always think 100 is a good number.
Yeah.
Because you think you don't want to, you know, poison the well too much. Because if you have way too many, if you do basically what they did in Generation 5, that was a huge shock for Generation 5. Because in that game, it predominantly, all of it were new Pokemon.
Right.
All. Which was like, what? I'm not used to this. So it was a big shock. I think people were like, okay, we're doing a brand new system, brand new technology. It's going to change the gameplay. Let's just calm it down a little bit. And I didn't mind it. Like the ones they brought in, some of them were absolute bangers. Some of them were fantastic. So I was like, yeah, you can have that. That's fine.
I think hearing that there was only 70 new Pokemon, at first it was kind of shocking. Ideally, you know, you want as many as possible. Mm. And I think at least 100 new Pokemon is ingrained in a lot of people. They just want to pass that magic number. But I do think this game marks the shift in Game Freak's design philosophy for the Pokemon. They made sure that every Pokemon has a gimmick or some very notable characteristic, either in terms of unique typing or a new ability or a signature move or a form change. There aren't really any filler Pokemon. There's nobody like Lumineon or Aloma Mola or something. Because all the Pokemon in Gen 6, they have something going on.
Yeah.
For example, Vivillon, you've got the gimmick of the wing patterns being different based on a variety of factors. Aegislash, he only knows four moves, but they all work in tandem with each other, and many are exclusive to that Pokemon. Inkay and Malamar are the only dark psychic type Pokemon.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see this design philosophy on focusing on uniqueness over quantity in the later generations as well.
Yeah.
I really love the Gen 6 Pokemon. I think many have incredible designs. You've got your cool guys like Greninja and Talonflame. You've got Tyrantrum, which is a T-Rex. Hawlucha, which is a Lucha Libre bird. Ghost Pumpkins, a shrimp whose claw is a rocket launcher. What are your favorite Gen 6 Pokemon?
You mentioned Tyrantrum. Oh my God, I love Tyrantrum. I love T-Rex. I often get called a T-Rex because I've got stumpy little arms and stumpy little legs, considering I'm 6'3". I love Sylveon. I think Sylveon. I wish that thing was more competitively viable because I absolutely love it. Some of them, Goodra. Love Goodra. Goodra is fantastic. Aegislash. What a gimmick Aegislash has.
Yes.
Love it. Greninja. You can't go. Greninja was so good. Literally, as soon as I saw Greninja, I just started throwing money at Nintendo. I was like, take it. Take all my money. Now you have won. Because you've made a ninja Pokemon and I want you. But I think, I literally look at them and go, right, who do I want in my team? Tyrantrum was definitely in there. Sylveon was definitely in there. Greninja and Goodra were in there. Who else did I pick? I'll probably Raichu because I always pick Raichu. Always have a Raichu. And it's like, because Raichu is my favorite Pokemon. So it always goes along with me. I was thinking, who else did I take with me? Probably was Squirtle, I imagine, because you get given one. So yeah. I think it would have been Squirtle would have been my extra one because that was my first ever starter. Yeah, so it's probably those two came along with the ride.
Yeah, another cool thing about the game is that you do get the Gen 1 Pokemon as a gift. But who was your starter for X and Y?
Oh, it was Greninja. Definitely was going down. I've been water every single generation apart from Sun and Moon. I will always go water.
We haven't touched on Kalos yet, the setting of the game. This is the first Pokemon game to be set in quote-unquote Europe, as Kalos is heavily inspired by France. Mm-hmm. Some landmarks include Lumiose City, which is the hub city that can be fully explored in 3D, and not just with a specific fixed camera. There's a lot of places inspired by French history, so you've got a lot of castles and palaces. It has a very luxury type of feel to it, and there's plenty of caves and nooks to find as well. What did you think of Kalos as a region?
Loved it. I thought Kalos was great. Like, it was a big, big step for the fact, it was based in France, and it was a fully 3D Pokemon game. So the pressure to get this right was absolutely immense. But I thought they did it really well. Like, I know you people can say, oh, is this the best that Game Freak can do? I don't really care about that. Call me an apologist, because a lot of people in the Pokemon community may say that they could do better. But do you know what? I had such a fun time going through Kalos. I like the places I could go see. I love the Eiffel Tower-esque in Lumiere City. I loved all that. Hmm. I thought the environments were good fun. And, you know, it basically... Do I think Omega Red and Alpha Sapphire are better? Yes, in the sense of, like, I still prefer their environments. But again, they'd had a second time to play with the engine. But I thought this, for a first attempt, I thought this is a great, great starter. I thought this was a great go. Not the characters, but I like the world. I really enjoyed the world. It was good.
It does kind of mimic Unova a bit, in that traversal is basically kind of a big circle. Mm-hmm. Once you get to Lumio City, there are different paths you can go to, but you eventually run into a dead end, but it has a bit more freedom than you'd expect. But compared to Unova, I think Kalos is much more diverse in terms of biomes, and the aesthetic design is a bit more cohesive. Though I'm not sure why the snowy area is at the bottom. I think you got to put that at the top. That's just how people's minds work. You
want the snow. Out of a mind F. I agree with that, definitely.
And the routes have a lot of alternate paths, and there's a ton of useful things to find when exploring. For example, there's a house you can find that have inverse battles, another new feature where all the type advantages are opposite of each other. And these fun little side things you can discover in the overworld make Kalos really exciting to explore. And I think Kalos maybe has the best gyms in the series. It really was the last game to have traditional gyms, and they did a great job in making each one seem creative. The bug gym has you bouncing on spider webs. There's a rock climbing gym where you need to ascend a mountain. One gym is a quiz show. Another one is a dollhouse, and you warp between the rooms. I think a lot of people kind of got tired of the gym formula, which is why Game Freak gets strayed away from it in these past few games. And the idea of entering a building and doing a mini dungeon has kind of been de-emphasized. But I think Gen 6 does a great job in showing how gyms can be interesting and why they were a staple for so long.
See, I love gyms. Mm. I have loved gyms, and I will literally go to like a gladiator arena and fight everyone who disagrees. I think they should stay. Like,
yes.
Let's be honest, what they did next, they went to Sun and Moon. Oh, go get the ingredients because I want to make some food. Oh, like, this is your show, so I'm going to be very nice. But if this was my show, I'd be effing and blinded all day long. That's ridiculous. Make me some food. No, poo. I don't want to make, I want to go a gym battle. I love my gyms. Like, and then you got in Scarlet and Violet. Oh, you're going to do a bit of a challenge. No, it's not a Scarlet and Violet. In Sword and Shield. And Scarlet and Violet. Yeah, they did the same thing. You're going to do little challenges. No, give me a gym. That's all I want is a gym. I don't want you to test the limits of your hardware. I just want a traditional gym. Just give me that. Is that so much to ask for? Like, it's literally putting on a comfy pair of shoes, walking into the water gym and going, right, I know what I'm getting here. Not this go do a side quest thing that's going to, you know, you play Scarlet and Violet, it's going to make the Nintendo Switch suddenly have a heart attack because you can't process so many things on the screen at once. Just give me a gym and I'm happy. Is that too much to ask for? Really?
I understand why they kind of moved away from it, because like you said before, the Trials and Sun and Moon, on paper, they seem, you know, quite different, and you have the totem Pokemon battles, which is kind of unique. But I think, you know, the window dressing around as not as exciting as doing a gym, which is kind of like a small mini dungeon.
Yeah, the totem battles are a good idea. Add them in, just put them in along with side a gym battle. Like, oh, you face three trainers. Now you've got to face it. Now you've got to do it. I would be up for that. Just add it in. Be great. But no, they've got to ruin it, haven't they?
Another element I've got to touch on is the PSS, the player search system. This is the main gadget for the game. And through here, you can access the GTS, Battle Spot, and new features like Wonder Trade, where you can trade for a random Pokemon, and O-Powers, which give boosts to other players. You can also see which of your friends are online, and there are passerbys, which are other people online who are in the same area as you, displayed on the bottom screen. How did you feel about the PSS?
I thought it was a good opportunity to play around with the online systems. Like, I didn't use any of the O-Powers. That wasn't my thing. Mine, again, was, again, I need to trade with somebody. Okay, we can easily get this set up. I need to want to play a battle with somebody. Okay, we can easily get this set up. I loved it. Like, ever since Generation 4, where you've been able to play online against other people, this has been like an important thing for me. I like matchmaking, playing online. It's got to be well done. And, you know, it's not perfect, but it's decent. I didn't mind it. I thought I can still get matches. I can, and for me, it's being able to trade with other people and getting it done properly. That is the thing. Yes, we had like the online trading system where it's like, I want a Pikachu. Okay, what do you want for it? I want a Mewtwo. yeah, okay, that's not happening. But I didn't really get involved in that. I was involved in chat rooms and stuff where you could actually get and organize the trade properly. And it worked so well. And that's how I eventually started, you know, getting to know people more in the competitive scene through actually having the chats off the game, but then you know, we got to play on the game. It was the best way of doing it. Definitely increased my awareness into what's out there, really.
I say this without hyperbole. I think this is the best online system Pokemon has ever had, and they've just been taking massive steps back since. You could clearly see which of your friends were online because they were displayed on the bottom screen. And the fact that you could just click on another random person in the same area as you in order to trade and battle makes it feel like you were playing a Pokemon MMO. So I always say that X and Y is a secret Pokemon MMO. I would often get random requests to battle, which was just so exciting because it felt like they spotted me on the field.
Yeah. And
things like O powers, which are passive buffs that just help people, it's kind of ahead of its time in terms of asynchronous multiplayer. I also love that you could just access the GTS, which has been stripped out of the main games now. You could access it anywhere. And I really feel like they should have built upon the PSS instead of trying something completely new for the other generations. And through the PSS, you could access super training. Did you mess with super training at all?
I'm trying to think. No, I don't think I played around with super training because I think there were other ways to do it. And I went, oh, that was it. No, I did it through mass because they had like basically you could find five Pokemon at once.
Yes, the horde battles. Yeah.
That's how I did it. That's how you EV train properly, baby. You do it through that, not through super training. You do it through that.
Yeah, super training was technically slower than horde battles or the quote-unquote normal way to EV train, but it did give people who haven't really messed with competitive Pokemon a kind of a different way or more accessible way to manage EVs and things like that. So listeners, if you don't know what super training was, it's basically an alternative way to EV train outside of normal Pokemon battles. It made it much more manageable to grind for specific EVs. And there were a lot of items that you could earn in the training mode to help adjust your Pokemon stats. I thought the mini games were pretty fun. And the items you got, like one that just completely cleared all your EVs, was really, really useful.
Very.
And it really helped me get into competitive battling this generation. And there were some other useful tools to help people get into more serious comp battling, like Destiny Knot. Being able to transfer your IVs to baby Pokemon is still way too annoying and complicated to make a real competitive team for me, even today. But the new additions really helped a lot.
Yeah, I think when it comes to competitive trading, they were trying to work out and get better systems to make this process, you know, smoother. And look, there's a basically a continuing online debate about whether you should basically clone Pokemon or gem them or make them yourself. I'm kind of now swayed to allowing somebody to gen Pokemon for me because I don't have the time anymore because I am literally a family man with a full-time job and there is absolutely no chance I have the time to be doing all that. And when statistically, it will give you no numerical advantage at all. It gives you nothing. But it was still a long process back then to try and EV train something from start to finish because, yes, you have to do all the breeding. And then when you get the one you want, then you need to start going and put it through its paces. And, oh, it took so long. Oh, the amount of hours I used to spend, the amount of grinding I used to do, literally, ugh, my poor D-pad on my consoles. They had no chance to survive. They really didn't.
Some other small stuff, there's horde battles, which we mentioned before, where you can fight five Pokemon at once. And it was quite awesome, even though it made your 3DS run at maybe 5 frames per second. And there were sky battles that could only be fought with flying Pokemon.
Yeah.
Gen 6 also introduced trainer customization for the first time, which was a major addition. And I do think you probably have more customizable options in Gen 6 compared to Scarlet and Violet.
Yeah.
And there's Friend Safari, which replaces the Safari Zone. Here, each of your registered friends on your 3DS unlock a special mini Safari Zone based on their friend code. So, for example, Friend A gives you a water-type zone where you can catch rare Pokemon you normally wouldn't find elsewhere, even sometimes the Gen 1 starters. So you can catch a Wartortle, which is pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And there's also Pokemon Ami, where you can pet your Pokemon. And again, this is taking advantage of those beautiful 3D models. Is there anything we missed or anything that stands out for you when you think of Pokemon X and Y?
Look, I have a lot of time for this game. And at the time of playing it, I love this a lot more than Generation 5. It really has taken me to go back to Generation 5 and kind of sit down with it and really have a heart-to-heart few whiskeys with it. But this generation, the amount of hours I spent on it, it took a while for me to get to stop this being my favorite game for a while until Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire came out, where I really felt they kind of perfected the system. And I thought that was the best 3DS game on the system for all those games. But look, getting to see my Pokemon, you know, in the really in 3D models was so good. Playing double battles in 3D was so good. It's one of those feelings like, you know, this is a bit special. This does tick that box to finally seeing a 3D Pokemon game. Oh, thank you very much, Game Freak.
The game reviewed very well. It has an 87 on Metacritic, which no Pokemon game since has topped. However, I do think it is viewed a bit negatively amongst the online Pokemon fandom. Why do you think a lot of people turned on the game despite the early strong impression?
Oh, because the Pokemon community can never be happy. Look, I've argued to death with so many people, and there's always the common argument is that Game Freak have X amount of money, which I get. They should give us a better product, which I get. But maybe I don't look for the same highs as other people do. I see that this game is basically a chess game with rock, paper, scissors. And so I know what we should be aiming for. We're not after like Final Fantasy Square Enix graphics. We don't need that. It's irrelevant. And honestly, you can never please the Pokemon community. It's just, it is one of the most, I'm going to get hate for this. It is one of the most, there are nice people. I'll make this very clear. If you're listening to this and you're saying, I'm not this, you're not toxic, that's not you then. But I swear to God, there are so much toxic people who play this game and literally pull everything down. So what? Enjoy it. If you're a nice person, enjoy the game. But people just think it should be better, it should be this, it should be that. Remember, this game is always geared towards children. I know there is adults who play this game. I know that. But it's still a child's game at the bare core root of it. I think we forget that sometimes. It's okay to like a video game, but people just want more out of Game Freak. They want to bleed them like a stone.
I definitely think it's certainly underrated compared to the other games in the franchise. Many like to compare it to Black and White, but I do think X and Y is better than Black and White. I know this opinion is in the minority, but I think all the new features that we talked about are just much more engaging than what Black and White offered. And a lot of people do harp on the story, but again, I don't really come to Pokemon for the story. The bad guy is bad. I care more about the world building and the atmosphere over the actual beat by beat plot. And I do think the world building is pretty interesting because Kalos as a region is kind of modern, but there's also a lot of like Renaissance era, beautiful mansions. There's castles. There's a lot of history there. So it's a really cool mix of both modern and traditional type of settings.
I thought the story was good. Like, you could see he was the bad guy from day dot. I don't think there was any big surprise there. But he just goes from, I'm going to broadcast TV stuff to, I'm going to nuke the world. I was like, yeah, fair play. Nuke
a good
the
point.
World. Go nuts, mate. It's like, this stepped up a notch. It's like, wow, you were previously like this little bad guy. Now we're just going to go to destroy everything. And for those who say, oh, it's a bit, you know, underrated, go play the original Diamond and Pearl games. Not Platinum. Go play Diamond and Pearl. They're bare bones as anything. I played them recently. I'm like, go play like they're even the remakes of them. Go play them and then you'll beg for X and Y. You really will. Because they have nothing. They are so bare bones, it's shocking.
Do you think if the game got a Z version, or a third version, would that help alleviate some of the game's criticisms?
100%. 100%. And everyone was waiting for a Z version for so long. And the only reason I think they weren't doing a Z version was because they had Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire in the background.
Yes.
That was the only reason made me think. And they thought, why bother, you know, making a Z version and perfecting this? Well, we'll perfect everything in the next game. And I was like, yeah, no qualms with that. I would have loved to see a Z version. I would have, because obviously it keeps that little trend going. But with Black and White, we didn't get Black and White 3 or 2.5 or 1.5. We just got Black and White 2 as our next one. But I think sometimes we also need to remember these games come out like in a 3-year cycle.
Yeah.
So that's quite quick. That's fast. Sometimes I'm just like, we need to just slow it down a little bit, because you want to basically let things cook a little bit and let the ideas go around, and you don't want to rush it.
I do think maybe we are a few years away, or maybe it will happen right after this podcast episode, of people being incredibly nostalgic for X and Y and then reclaiming it in its place in the Pokemon pantheon. Mm. I love this game. It's one of my favorite Pokemon games. And I don't think Game Freak has made a better game since. At the time, things like seeing the Pokemon in 3D and the trainer customizations felt like huge steps ahead. And I do think Kalos is a very fun place to explore, and it's filled with great Pokemon. We didn't touch on this, but I do believe it maybe still has the largest Pokedex out of all the games. And you could transfer Pokemon that weren't catchable in the game via the Pokemon Bank, which again was a crazy feature. Mm. So you could just trade up a Totodile from your old games and see it in 3D, which was pretty wild.
If you're trying to get it from the Rube, so the old games, the red and blue, red, blue, yellow, gold, silver, crystal, you couldn't transfer from there. Right. Sorry, boys, you're all dead. My original team are forever dead. But if you went from Ruby, Sapphire, Emerald, that was not fun. That was not a fun process, because believe you or me, Pokemon Bank don't work with those games. So you've got to go from them to Diamond and Pearl, from Diamond and Pearl to Black and White 2.
I think it's safe to say that we will eventually get a remake of X and Y. What would you like to see in a potential remake?
Ooh, good question. Do away with the triple battles, not needed.
Hmm.
You don't need any of that. Look, I always say when you make a Pokemon, make a hard mode. And because Pokemon are very statistically very easy to do, and there hasn't really been a challenging one. Actually, since Scarlet and Violet, I found that difficult but reasons I put on myself. So there's often modded games that people make their own version, ROM hacks. And there's one I played called Radical Red, and it was a remake of the Fire Red games. Holy fudge. That thing is so hard, but so good at the same time.
Mm.
I was like, if you could give me that consistently in any Pokemon game, I would love it. It would make actually every battle as tense as anything. Rather than put self-restricted limit, like my own limits on my own challenge, I want to see the AI do it itself. What else would have probably got? Probably more post-battle stuff. Like, I love the fact that you've got the different post-game battles that you can try and get to 50 battles, because that's really lacking in any Pokemon game since. Look at Generation 6, you had the Battle Tree, which was poo. In Generation 7, you had the Battle Tower, which was poo. And I like the fact that the subway systems we've had. So Generation 6 was the last one we ever did that. It was the last ones. I keep Generation 6. Generation 7 was the Battle Tree, sorry. But Generation 6 was the last time we ever actually had anything decent post-game. And I really think, you know, just flesh that out more. Flesh it out. And I'd love it. I just want more post-game stuff. It's all I ever want. Like, harder battles. And we don't get that in newer games. We really don't.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we pretty much touched on everything relating to Pokemon X and Y. So listeners, I hope if you didn't like it before, hopefully you have a new perspective of the game. And if you do like it, well, maybe this will inspire you to pick up your 3DS and go through the game once again. So Danny, thanks for joining me. Where can people find you?
They could find me over on Podbean or anywhere where you listen to any of your podcasts, and just search in for Retro Wars and you'll find it. It's going to be a picture of the old Sonic logo with a Sonic with a Sega Mega Drive or a Genesis, wherever you're from, and a Super Nintendo fighting. And each week I will cover an old retro video game. And if you've got kids, you don't want them to hear it. Let's put it like that, because it's a bit expletive. But we have fun. We have games. And yeah, it's a big mess. It's not high quality, but it's just chill out, have a beer, and just relax. That's my show.
Great. And listeners, the links to everything are in the podcast description, so check it out. Danny, once again, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. It's been great fun.
Let's take a brief ad break.
In today's age, you need a podcast you can trust. That's why you need Hair of the Dogcast. Entertaining and well-informed discussions on both video games and beer. meet our local podcast team. Dylan.
I'm out here on the street, Brad, and everyone's clamoring for better podcasts.
Our new rookie correspondent, Tyler.
I play The Witcher.
And I'm Brad, and I'm slowly learning to hate myself and video games. And Dylan's reporting to us live from Kingdom Hearts 3.
There's a lot of Frozen here. Too much Frozen.
Hair of the Dogcast is a podcast you can trust. On your favorite podcast app every Wednesday or whenever I decide to post it. Only on the Tokyo Beat Podcast Network.
That's it for games. Now for the feature. Today's feature is about Suzume Publishing Antique Book Club, or Suzume Shupan Koshobu in Japanese. It doesn't seem to have an English name, so the one I came up with is a fairly literal translation of the Japanese one. It's a bookstore located in Koshigaya, Saitama. What's Koshigaya famous for? At first, I thought nothing, but Wikipedia says they are famous for producing Daruma dolls. But when I went there, it's not like they had a big Daruma doll at the train station. It seemed like a fairly normal Japanese suburb or bedroom community. But hidden in this humble locale is Suzume, a bookstore dedicated to video game books. They also tout that they sell books about erotica and mahjong, but mostly video games. It's a very small bookstore that's filled with hundreds, maybe thousands, not sure, didn't count, but it has rows and rows of video game books. From the floor to the ceiling, you'll find magazines, novels, nonfiction works, comics, and everything else you could possibly think of. It also serves as the home base of Suzume Publishing, a small indie publishing company focusing on video game books. Sadly, I can't find a whole lot online about the origins of the place. The Twitter account for the store opened in 2019, and the publishing arm's Twitter is 2017. Most Japanese impressions are from around 2020, so I can only assume that it opened up in the past few years. Despite being somewhat new, it has a large and impressive collection of Japanese books from the 80s to today. It's run by Kagi Yamada, who I did speak to and I got his business card. I was looking for it earlier, but honestly, I have no idea where it is. Please tell me I put it in one of my mini clear files. It's about a 10-minute walk from Shin Koshigaya Station, and it truly is kind of in the middle of nowhere. The path to the store is just streets and houses. But you'll eventually see a sign that says Fuji Shopping, a shotengai or Japanese shopping street. This was not the luxurious, bustling street you see in Tokyo. It was really just a small collection of buildings with a makeshift roof. I didn't see anyone else there except for an old man who was running a small festival game shop. He was asleep in a chair, so I didn't bother him. But the main event, of course, is Suzume. The outside is pretty unspectacular, but there's posters and other gaming books on display, so you can't help but be drawn in. Once you're inside, well, it's really just one room. Most of the books are on the walls, with a small section in the middle that showcases an exhibit. They had video game doujinshi books, or fan books, as the exhibit on my visit. Many were black and white video game magazines made by fans, which was a popular trend back in the 80s and 90s. That's how Game Freak started, believe it or not. The shelves are broken up into their own little sections. There's an area for video game magazines, one for strategy guides, one for fiction books, and an area for nonfiction books, etc. And within these sections, there are further demarcations, such as categorizing the magazines by their name or by what generation they covered. One section is dedicated to 32-bit games, for example. If you're looking for something specific, it's relatively easy to find, though it's likely just faster to ask Mr. Yamada. Many of the books are in excellent condition, even the magazines. Every one is in a plastic cover to help protect it from damages, so a mag from 1995 looks like it could have been printed yesterday. It's pretty incredible how specific a lot of these old magazines were. Falcom had their own magazine, every console had one too, like Sega Saturn and PC Engine. I love old Japanese gaming magazines due to their incredible covers, often featuring custom art. Marukatsu PC Engine had their own cast of characters that would often appear on the cover, dressed like characters from whatever game they were featuring. Even if you can't read Japanese, they make for great display pieces. I've always thought Japanese magazines had incredibly creative layouts that are vibrant and engaging. You want to own it as a piece of art, and not just as a piece of journalism. Of course, they have a lot of Famitsu editions as well, even going back to when it was called Famicom Tsushin. And the shop even has the very first issue of Famitsu on display. It's about $130, which is both super expensive for a magazine, but also manageable if you're a hardcore collector. It's not like this thing is a Charizard card. The guides also fall into this category. Many have a lot of custom unofficial art. I picked up a Zelda 1 and Super Mario 64 guide, and both are filled with hand-drawn maps, comics, strange renditions of enemies, and just a lot of other fun things to discover in the books. They sold these pretty cheaply back in the day, but these were really packed to the brim with handcrafted content. Most of the fun of visiting Suzume is discovery, coming across things you had no idea that existed. Did you know there's a King of Fighters 98 for Koma manga? I didn't. I also took a picture of a small guide called Kortega Family Computer Da, or This is the Famicom. I showed it to my wife and she freaked out. She said that she had it as a child. So for Japanese people, this place likely houses a ton of nostalgic items that are in excellent condition. As someone who did not grow up in Japan, though, it's really a treasure trove of gaming artifacts I never knew existed. The vast majority of their stock is retro stuff, but they also do have some more recent works, especially in the art book section. I really could just spend this entire segment listing off books I saw. To be honest, a lot of it is difficult to explain out of context and without pictures. Like Keep On Super Strategy Guide for SimCity that features a real-life statue of the Mario statue from the game. Outside of books, they do sell some other random items like video game vinyl records, and a few rare video games too. They had the multi-screen Mario Bros. Game & Watch, and weirdly stone protectors for the Super Famicom. This is a game based off of a short-lived American cartoon series. You can buy it on Steam for about $10, but wouldn't you rather spend $500 to own a Japanese boxed copy? Now, the big question, how are the prices? To be honest, they aren't the best around. I looked up that Zelda guide I bought online to see how much it was going for, and it was cheaper to get it online than in the shop. But again, you gotta add in shipping and handling, but I still think even with all the fees, it was cheaper to buy it online. But there is novelty in just seeing it with your own eyes and picking it up there. There's really no shortage of vintage bookstores in Japan. Book Off, of course, and Tsurugaya has a section for video game books. But that stock is completely random, and in terms of just sheer number of video game books, Suzume easily tops any Book Off or Tsurugaya you would come across. And I touched on it earlier, but this bookstore does have a publishing branch. They put out a book recently called Introduction to Video Game Books History. You can probably guess what it's about. It chronicles about 300 books from 1984 to 2022. People who own it have said that it's worth checking out, so if that sounds up your alley, then it's probably not a bad pickup. So, is it worth a visit? Well, it's just so far out of the way, it's about an hour train ride from any spot in Tokyo, and there's not a whole lot there except for this bookstore. It would be much easier to recommend if it was in Akihabara, for example. Then it would be a must visit. But if you are a hardcore fan of video game books, or have something very specific you are looking for, it might be worth contacting Mr. Yamada to inquire about the availability and price. Though as a side note, one other oddity of Koshigaya is a restaurant called Toy Box Diner. This is a burger place filled with a ton of retro toys, mostly from America. It literally looks like a McDonald's from the 1980s. It's got a ton of statues and signs. I have no idea where they procured these items. Like, did they import them? I can't imagine them ever existing in Japan. But going to a weird fake McDonald's and then checking out a video game bookstore, that sums up what's great about a short excursion outside of Tokyo. There's always something fun and unique to do. Well, that's it for the feature. Now for the news. There's quite a bit of news this week. The biggest and saddest being that the online services for 3DS and Wii U will cease in April 2024. Pokemon Bank may not be affected though, but you should probably move those guys over to home if you haven't done so already. This is a pretty standard news item for Nintendo. Not too long ago, they cut off the ability to buy anything on their hardware, and before that, you couldn't add any money. So it was only a matter of time before all online services ceased. A lot of people are, of course, angry about this, and there's always the issue of game preservation, but we've been through this dance so many times that I can't really get angry about it. 13 years of online play for the 3DS is a pretty good run if you want to quantify it like that. I'm trying to think of what the big prominent 3DS and Wii U titles that are very online heavy. Maybe Super Mario Maker? I know years ago they took away the ability to upload levels and even delisted it from the eShop, but you can still play existing levels, right? It would be sad for all those levels to disappear. You can download them to your game, so if you're a hardcore Mario Maker Wii U fan, I'd get on that. I think I am most sad about something I talked about in the episode. Pokemon X and Y's PSS will no longer work. It's like removing the Mona Lisa from the Louvre. It does make me wonder, when will they cut off online services for the Switch? It's got to happen eventually, right? Are we talking 2028? 2030? It's pretty wild to think that something could be so successful, have millions of people playing online at the same time, and then one day, it just drops to zero. That's life, I guess. Some good news, Nintendo is teasing wind-up Pikmin toys. These are smaller versions of classic creatures like Bulborbs, Blowhogs, and Wallyhops. Nintendo Tokyo has been posting videos on their Twitter account, and these things look absolutely amazing. They move just like the creatures, and up close, they're rich with detail and have excellent paint jobs. Hopefully the real deal is just as good. They announced the wind-up toys and a few other new Pikmin items will launch at Nintendo Tokyo, Osaka, and the newly opened Nintendo Kyoto on October 17th. It's a single blind box item, so what creature you get will be randomized, but typically you can buy a set that guarantees all the variations. Honestly, I might just get the whole set. It reminds me a bit of the Small Fry toy that you pull back and it moves like a car. That thing was more than $10, so I can see this hitting the same price point unless they are really, really small. Either way, I'm there. Keeping with Nintendo Tokyo, they will host pop-up shops around Japan under the Mario-themed Get the Item campaign. The whole campaign is really just Mario standees, and then there's a pop-up shop. Nothing too crazy. I was hoping for some crazier collaborations or events to celebrate Wonder, but it's been fairly muted so far. But if you're outside of Tokyo, these pop-up shops are a great way to grab some merch. Honestly, I'm really starting to think that we need a second Nintendo Tokyo, considering how popular the store is. If you're more of a Kirby guy, Family Mart has you covered with a special Kirby campaign that is running right now until October 16th. Why? Who knows? It's weird that Kirby has a bigger Konbini campaign than Mario, when Mario has a game out in a few weeks. The big ticket items are the Kirby-themed food. There's a tomato bacon sandwich, roll cake that's shaped like the Invincible lollipop, pink apple bread, and an apple jelly drink. I got the drink, which I highly recommend. It's almost like DIY a bit. It comes in a big cup, and you put in the sugar and some other powder to fizz up the liquid and turn it into jelly with cream on top. It actually tasted pretty good for a convenience store jelly drink. There's also a special Kirby-shaped eShop card. You can win a tumbler, get some Kirby wallpaper if you do a GPS check-in. So if you like Kirby, it's definitely worth popping by your local Family Mart. I did pass on the clear file, though. I have enough Kirby-themed ones. Yet another collaboration, Pronto will have a special Pokemon campaign from October 12th. The big drink item is sweet potato and chestnut with a Pikachu and Eevee cookie on top. It's a mix of brown and yellow, so it does suit those Pokemon, and it's very autumny. I'm not a big fan of these potato drinks, though. There's also a Detective Pikachu coffee with a Detective Pikachu design on the foam, and a lot of food, including Charizard spaghetti and a Mimikyu pancake with Mimikyu and Pikachu stamped on the pancake. If you're not hungry and just want some merch, there's a Detective Pikachu coffee cup, Detective Pikachu branded coffee beans, and Pokemon aprons, tumblers, and tote bags. This is a surprisingly big collaboration. You don't really see these chain cafes like Pronto or Dotor get these types of merch items, so maybe this will be a new trend. I'm all for it, though. Nintendo needs to cross over with every aspect of my life. I want to use a Pikmin ATM machine. Okay, I think we can end the episode now. Thanks, as always, for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. Leave a 5-star review as well. It really helps with visibility. The podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Threads, Instagram, Blue Sky. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be on October 22nd. And yes, it'll be Mario-rific. See you next time. Matane!